The whole conservatory knew that when He Luting was a child, his elder brother had owned a French music text, and the book so enthralled Comrade He that, at night, he would sneak downstairs and copy it out of hand. Fascinated by the construction of Western music, he taught himself staff notation. When he finally became a conservatory student in the 1920s, he was famous for falling out of bed with his hands still moving in the air. Sparrow longed to know what He Luting had been playing in his dreams. Had he been performing or composing? Had he been dreaming of his teacher, Huang Zi, who had himself studied under Paul Hindemith? Could dreams shed light on the architecture of the music in his head? Sparrow, too, dreamed all the time of things he had not written. Each morning when he woke, he heard these pieces like a vanishing noise in the street, and he wanted to weep over the music he had lost. "No need to waste time. Just put your threats in Liberation Daily and see what else I say." He Luting's glasses had slipped far down his nose. In response, the stranger wore a complacent smile. Sparrow hurried on. Further along the corridor, he arrived at the office he shared with Old Wu, a prodigy who played the erhu as if it were no more strenuous than clipping his toenails. He hadn't seen Old Wu in weeks. On Sparrow's desk was a note written in the margins of a scrap of newspaper. "Teacher Sparrow, thank you for lending me your copy of Musical Life of the Germans. I read it in a single sitting and couldn't sleep all night. Shall I come by your office today, around 1? Respectfully yours, Jiang Kai." Sparrow reread the letter. At 1 this afternoon, Yin Chai would be performing Tchaikovsky in the auditorium to oceanic waves of applause. Kai must have forgotten. Sparrow slipped the note into his desk. The 4 ivory walls of the little room seemed to angle towards the window's opening. He took out his Symphony No. 3, shoe prints and all, and laid the first movement across his desk. Try as he might, he could not smooth out the crumpled pages. He took up his pencil anyway. Time itself, the hours, minutes, and seconds, the things they counted and the way they counted them, had sped up in the new China. He wanted to express this change, to write a symphony that inhabited both the modern and the old, the not yet and the nearly gone. The ticking in the first measures was a quote from Prokofiev's Whirring Machines in Symphony No. 7, and in the foreground was a dance, Allegro Risoluto, quickening until the bars were rickety with steps, twisting free at last, like a gunshot to the sky. A free fall into the second movement. A scherzo, a trio of violins that did not sound like themselves, withdrawing as winds and brass began a slow march, a sound gone just as it was learning to be heard. From the opposite wall, Chairman Mao gazed at him with a knowing smile. "What have you ever written?" Chairman Mao said, chidingly. "That is original. What can you possibly say that is worthy?" Time passed, and the paper grew warm in its patch of morning light. 3/4 of Sparrow's time was spent meeting quotas for the latest political campaign, and the other 1/4 teaching composition music theory. His own Symphony No. 1 had been performed, and well reviewed, only to be criticized by the Union of Composers. The symphony, they said, suffered from formalism and useless experimentation. The solemnity of the 3rd movement did nothing to alleviate the people. And the meaning overall was not immediately clear. If it hadn't been for He Luting's protection, the criticisms would have been far worse. Symphony No. 2, which he knew to be a work of great beauty, languished in his desk drawer, having never been submitted for approval. Last month, he had set 6 poems of Wang Wei and Bertolt Brecht to music, but these, Sparrow knew, were better left unheard. His students wanted revolutionary accessibility, and his superiors tried to educate him on the correct political line. But what line could this be? As soon as he contained it in his hand, it opened its wings and filled the sky. What musical idea stayed fixed for a year or a lifetime, let alone a revolutionary age? He squeaked open his desk drawer and looked again at Kai's confident handwriting. Like He Luting, Kai had come from the remote countryside. He was playful and virtuosic, possessed an extraordinary memory, and loved music as mysteriously, as confusedly, as Sparrow himself. But Kai was prepared to succeed, to be a renowned musician. One surely had to be already successful in one's own mind. Only musicians with this nature could rise above the others. Life, Sparrow felt, would have no choice but to be generous to Kai. He tried not to think of his own diminishing opportunities. He erased the last 20 measures he had written. For a long time he sat thinking until the room itself became another room. On the empty page, a line came to him. The line moved forward along a steepening curve. He followed it, no longer conscious of the act of writing. The morning passed. Sparrow was thinking of the letter from Wen the Dreamer and the mysterious Comrade Glass Eye when the door jumped open and Zhu Li appeared, pale as an unlit candle. She was holding a green thermos, her violin case, and a paper bag.
"Cousin," she said, "isn't your stomach rumbling? I waited for you in room 103, but you never came."
He had forgotten. She waved his apology away and grinned. In her old blue dress, Zhu Li looked tired, but also energized, older than her 14 years. He got up and went to the little table, laid with cups and dishes, picked out 2 that were the least tea-stained, and examined the package of pear syrup candies that old Wu had received from an admirer, a girl nicknamed Biscuit. Old Wu had sampled 1 and abandoned the remainder. He poured tea and scattered a few candies on a plate. Zhu Li was looking intently at the pages on his desk. She was humming the melody now. Lost in thought, she unlatched her violin case, lifted her violin, and began to experiment with the phrasing.
"Not yet, Zhu Li."
She lowered her arm.
"But Sparrow, listen to this. I can already hear how..."
"The second movement isn't even finished. I've barely begun it."
"Barely begun it? You've exhausted yourself on this symphony. Cousin, can't you see it's the most sublime thing you've ever written? I think you should show it to Conductor Liu right away. You trust him, don't you?"
There was a boisterous knock, and the door opened again. Here was Kai, looking as if he had woken only minutes ago and run from Changsha to reach them. He was wearing a knock-off army cap and a rumpled shirt that was, comically, grass-stained. After greeting them, he immediately crossed the room.
"What are you playing, Comrade Zhu Li?"
She frowned at him and smoothed her dress.
"It's nothing," Sparrow said. "Just a few lazy thoughts of mine."
He gathered the sheets, Kai's note, and an essay he had been consulting, and cleared everything away.
"Kai," he said, "if you hurry, you can still make it to Yin Chai's recital. You won't even be late."
"But aren't we meeting? I left you a note."
His face, even his handsome cap, seemed to fall.
Sparrow felt as if he had accidentally closed a piano lid on the young man's fingers.
"Teacher Sparrow is composing,"
Zhu Li said solemnly.
"Have you eaten, Kai? Take these."
Sparrow watched the paper bag leap from one hand to the other. He felt old when he said, "Please don't leave crumbs on Wu Li's sofa." Kai looked hungrily into the paper bag. "Old Wu. He'll send his mother to clean them, or maybe his grandmother." His cousin let a laugh escape. They were so light-hearted, these two. Zhu Li's arms were bare, but she seemed not to feel the breeze of the open window. Kai looked at him with a direct, unsettling frankness. "It would be good to go outside, stroll in the park and listen to the music of the people." The sun warmed Sparrow's hands. "Come, teacher. You've been at work since dawn, and wasn't it your birthday?"
"He never celebrates," Zhu Li said. "He starves himself of joy. Luckily, joy seeps into all his compositions."
"Don't either of you have lessons?" Sparrow said, trying to maintain his dignity.
"All the pianists are downstairs, writing self-criticisms. I stayed up all night reading the book you lent me, and then I came at 2 in the morning to work on Mozart's Concerto No. 9. It was just me and the stray dogs and the wind. Even the most stubborn old grandmas weren't out lining up for meat."
"Up since 2 a.m.?"
Zhu Li said, clearly impressed. Sparrow tried to think of an escape route. He wanted to be alone with the window, the papers on his desk, and the freedom of his thoughts.
"An hour," Zhu Li said. "Steal an hour from your life and give it to us."
She smiled at him, a smile as big and open-hearted as Aunt Swirl's when he was a child. And so he did. In the park, Zhu Li and the pianist walked on either side of him, as if afraid Sparrow would make a run for it. What do the sparrow and the swallow know, he thought again, of the ways of swans? There was a swan, as it happened, in the shade of the pond, fluffing her gray-white wings, trying to appear larger and more deadly than she was. He heard the softness of her trilling.
"The room I live in," the pianist was saying, "is the size of 1.5 men lying down. I have just enough space to turn over and back again."
Julie's violin case swung as she walked.
"How come you don't board at the conservatory? Maybe you prefer sleeping in a cave?"
"I had to pull all sorts of strings to get this terrible room, but it's near my stepfather. He was ill last year. Anyway, the mice are good company." Zhu Li ducked under a low branch.
"Be careful, or the mice will multiply and take over the cat's room."
When Kai laughed, his hair stood upright in the wind. Without Sparrow's noticing the transition, Zhu Li was telling the pianist about Ba Lut and the confrontation with the public security officers this morning. The pianist's walk slowed.
"What camp was your father at again?"
he said.
"I don't know, but it's in Gansu province, isn't it, cousin?"
"I'm not sure, Zhu Li."
She tensed. Faint perspiration gleamed on her forehead and her cheeks. She looked as if she could take on any campaign, criticism, or family member and leave them battered on the floor.
"You don't have to worry about me, cousin,"
she said, her voice low.
"I know when to keep my mouth shut. If only you could hear me in our political study class. I think I've memorized more slogans than the premier himself."
She lifted her chin defiantly. Her recklessness, her casualness with words, stunned him. His cousin had been this way ever since Swirl's return. But perhaps he thought this bravado was not for him, but for Kai. The sun touched everything now.
They attempted to find refuge on a bench under a flowering pear tree. They sat as if they were alone and self-contained, the joy of only a few minutes ago dissolving. Perhaps it was the heat that made them quiet. Nobody stood nearby, yet Sparrow felt the weight of someone, or some attentive presence. There was shouting in the distance, or maybe laughing. "This morning," Kai said, his voice barely audible. "The president of the conservatory was in the newspapers. Did you read it? Liberation Daily has a full page on him. Wenhui Bao, too. They say He Luting is anti-party and anti-socialist, and that the most damaging accusations are coming from inside the conservatory."
"I thought you were practicing all morning,"
Zhu Li said. Kai paused.
"I think that half my life might be spent running from one position to another, until I trip and make a fatal mistake."
"Have you been to Wuhan?" Sparrow asked, wanting to change the subject. He knew He Luting was under investigation, of course, but Kai's words still chilled him.
"Forgive me, teacher. I'm only a student, and yet I feel that I can be very free with you. What did you ask me?"
"Would you like to go to Wuhan?"
"With you?"
the pianist said.
"Yes. If you have time to spare during the break. The journey and my research would need 3 or 4 days, perhaps longer. I'm looking for an assistant. I've been commissioned by the conservatory to gather..."
"Yes,"
the pianist said. "But I haven't told you why."
"I'll go."
Zhu Li was hugging her violin case to her chest, as if it concealed her. She refused to be a child and demand to go with them. She had her mother to think of, too. One day soon, she thought, she would play for her father, whose face she no longer recalled, but who used to sing, "Little girl, where are you going? Tell your father, and he will take you. Tell your father, and he will find a map, bring the tea, make the sun lift, and string the trees along the road." Was it a poem, a story, or something he had composed? "Zhu Li," he would say, "little dreamer." She let go of his voice and heard Ravel, the song itself, and her shoes scratching the pebbles each time she shifted her weight. She could see the light, and the park, and her cousin, and Kai. But these pictures were only tenuously connected to the sound of the violin in her head. She heard it on waking, and she knew it continued relentlessly through her sleeping hours. She herself came and went, not truly real, but the music had no beginning. It persisted, whether she was there or not, awake or not, aware or sleeping. She had accepted it all her life, but lately she had begun to wonder what purpose it served. Prokofiev, Bach, and Old Bay occupied the space that the party, the nation, and Chairman Mao occupied for others. Why was this? How has she been made differently? After her parents had been taken away from Bingpai, she had been cut into an entirely different person. There was a man limping across the park, one hand holding a rip in his shirt, as if this unsightliness bothered him more than the blood that ran down his face. People stared as he passed, but no one spoke. Instead, a cold ring of quiet seemed to expand around this injured stranger, like water filling a plastic bag. Zhu Li walked back to the conservatory alone. Her cousin and Jiang Kai had gone ahead, the two of them serious as Soviet spies, leaning towards one another, the pianist's hand on the small of Sparrow's back, the place, she knew, Sparrow had sustained an injury. He worked on his compositions for 18 hours a day. Often she came home from the conservatory to find him lying on the floor of his closet room, in terrible pain. She would massage the spasms in his back and scold him for working too hard. It was as if Sparrow feared all the music inside him would be shut off like a tap gone dry. But honestly, who had ever heard of a sparrow without music? Ahead of her, Kai turned, lifted one eyebrow, and grinned at her. The pianist had the same open, honest smile as Premier Zhou Enlai. She imagined the coffin-sized room he lived in, the rough floors and rodents, and wondered how Kai had ever managed to learn piano if he had grown up in a destitute village outside of Changsha. What kind of strings could a village boy pull? The pianist was a bag of tricks, she concluded. He wore his rural background well, like a penny novel wrapped inside an elegant cover. When not smiling, though, he had a face that could only be described as vigilant. Her violin case swung with the rhythm of her steps. A procession of carts passed, each one weighed down with oil drums, the drivers sweating ferociously as if they were pedaling up Mount Ba itself. At the corner of Huaihai Road, she saw conservatory students fluttering around Yin Chai, who had the glazed expression of someone who had withstood hours of adoration. The prettiest one, Biscuit, carried a trophy of flowers. Empress Biscuit detached herself from the group, came over, and overwhelmed Zhu Li with revolutionary slogans, inside of which was posed, like a bee sting, the line, "I saw you leaving with handsome Jiang Kai." Zhu Li blinked and said, "The son of Mao Zedong gives new fervor to my music," and clutched her violin to her chest. Biscuit looked at her knowingly. The beauty queen would never be a great violinist, Zhu Li thought, sidestepping Biscuit's velvety hair, which curled in long arabesques against the wind. She hid the moon and shamed the flowers, as poets said, but she played Beethoven as if he had never been alive. She decided not to practice after all, and ran abruptly into the road, hopping into a passing tram decorated with a banner that said, "Protect Chairman Mao." It was so crowded, it squeezed even her envy out, so that when she entered the laneway off Beijing Road, she felt fine and light. Arriving home, she crossed the inner courtyard and entered the kitchen so unassertively that she caught her mother in the act of pocketing a spoon. Startled, Swirl turned. A handful of dried mung beans showered to the ground. Zhu Li went to the table, clapped a mosquito between her hands, and pretended she had witnessed nothing.
"Ma," she said, turning back, "I'm perfecting Ravel's Cigane. It's incredibly difficult."
"Ravel?" her mother said, pleased.
"Shall I play it for you soon?"
"Yes, my girl."
Her mother smiled, and a few more beans clicked and clacked on the tiled floor. 5 years of hard labor, Sparrow always reminded her, watching people who had done no wrong disappear, could not be wiped away so quickly. Yet still, Zhu Li wanted to shake her mother, drag her mind back from the camps, and make her present. What mattered was the here and now, and not the life before. What mattered were the changeable things of today and tomorrow, and not the ever infinitely unbearable, unchanging yesterday. She got a broom and quickly swept up the beans, rinsed them in the sink, and spread them to dry on a clean cloth.
"Ma,"
she said. But her mother was now at the kitchen table. Zhu Li went to her, wanting to ask forgiveness for the disrespectful thoughts in her head, but then she noticed the two traveling bags on the floor, and the papers, maps, and notebooks on the table. Zhu Li picked up one of the notebooks, opened it, and began to read. Her mother's handwriting covered page after page, persistent, balanced, sharp. Du Li recognized the story right away. Da Wei's radio station in the desert, May 4th's journey into the western borderlands, and the great revolution that had overtaken their lives. The tantalizing epic book of records.
"You're making a new copy?"
Du Li said.
"Ma!"
"I finally finished it this morning."
Her mother drew a widening circle on the biggest map.
"Your father's camp was here," Swirl said. "But if he returned to Gansu province, I think he would avoid this region."
Du Li could not follow her mother's trajectories. They crisscrossed and overran one another like the interlacing of a bird's nest.
"So I should begin my search here," her mother concluded, and her fingertip came to rest on an open place.
Du Li wanted to take her mother's frail hand, lift it off the map, and hide it in her own. She wanted to take the map and burn it in a stove.
"How would you do that?" she said quietly. "Your aunt and I will go together. We traveled the length of this country when we were young." "It's not the same as it was." "True. Back then there was the war against Japan, famine, and then the nationalists bombed the Yellow River, and terrible flooding came."
"That's not what I meant,"
Du Li said.
"The neighborhood grandmas will talk and the public security men will break down the door again. They'll say you're siding with a convicted rightist, and then what?"
She wanted to say, but did not. "How can you even think of leaving me again? Don't I matter? Isn't there any part of you for me and not for him?"
"Big Mother will be teaching a new model opera in Gansu province," Swirl said. "Since she's leader of the song and dance troupe, she arranged for me to occupy her. She already told the neighbors she's going to handle my resurrection back into society. She told them that once I had lived in a Gansu mud hut for a few weeks, I would overcome the wrongs I committed and the idiocies of my youth."
Her mother reached out, hesitantly, to touch the loose ends of Du Li's hair. Her eyes were forthright and calm.
"Foolish girl," she said softly, teasingly. "I've already been to the sea and back. This is only a small journey."
Her mother's gray shirt and pants were ironed and clean, proper and unassuming, but there was a look in her mother's eyes that had nothing to do with propriety and obedience. There was no resignation, only a sharp knife in a pool of water. Her mother, she thought, had all the attributes of the famous proverb, "One who thrives in calamity, but perishes in soft living."
"Ma,"
Du Li said,
"please let me go with you."
Even as she said it, she knew she didn't want to leave.
"Big Mother can arrange it, can't she?"
Her mother said nothing, as if the thought itself was not worth hearing. Instead, Swirl picked up the copy she had made of Chapter 17 of the Da Wei novel and began to ramble like the evening newsreader. She would make further copies of all the chapters, she said, each one bound into a separate notebook, 31 notebooks in all. But in each one, the text would be marginally altered, and the date of copying added. They would use the same codes as the original author, folding locations and information into the names of Da Wei and May 4th, clues meant only for Du Li's father, changes he would recognize immediately as not belonging to the original book of records.
"But what location?"
Du Li asked.
"It's too dangerous for him to come here."
Her mother had thought of everything.
The location belonged to a third party, the Lady Dostoevsky, who had been resurrected by the party and was now living in Gansu province, working for a plant and flower clinic.
"She has given the clinic a wondrous name," her mother said. "She calls it Notes from the Underground." The idea suddenly came to me. I remember how Dawei sent messages to his lover over the radio broadcasts, through the public airwaves, hiding in plain sight. Big Mother and I will keep making copies as we go, and will scatter them all over the Northwest. She's already used the conservatory's machine to make a dozen copies of Chapter 17, your father's favorite chapter. Wen might go without food for 5 days, but he can't resist the literature section of the bookshops. We added the date, you see. As soon as your father sees it, he'll know the message wasn't left by the author. The message could only have come from us. Julie put her arms around her mother. Her mother hugged her back, but her arms were light as wings.
"When do you leave, Ma?"
she asked. "Tomorrow morning." She gripped her mother tighter. She remembered the little house they'd had in Bingpai, and the hidden underground cavern filled with books and musical instruments. She had climbed down into it as if into a magic kingdom, and, in doing so, altered her parents' lives forever. Did such caverns still exist? She wondered. If she found another, would she enter it again? Her mother's eyes flashed an unnerving light, part anger, part madness, part love.
"Julie, be careful what you say and whom you trust. No one is immune. Everyone thinks that with one betrayal, they can save themselves and everyone they love."
She looked down at the map again, as if it, and not this room, this city, was the real world.
"Think only of your studies. Don't write to me. Don't be distracted. Promise me you won't take any risks. Concentrate on your music."
As Julie was on her way out again, Big Mother Knife was in the midst of winnowing through clothes, dried fruit, sewing needles, sleeping mats, various washcloths, a cooking pot, and a collection of knives, trying to fit them into Ba Lut's army rucksacks. "I'd rather have this cleaver than this pair of trousers," Big Mother said, thoughtfully, holding both items up for display.
"I'd rather you had the trousers," Swirl said. "Come, tuck the cleaver into my quilt."
Big Mother started singing a verse from How the North Wind Blows, interspersing bawdy words, and Swirl laughed and said,
"Cover your ears, Julie."
"Or add your own verse," her aunt said, and the two sisters giggled and folded the clothing into smaller and smaller squares. Da Shan had come home from school, and was lying on the sofa with Chairman Mao's guerrilla warfare essays on his stomach.
"Take me with you," he said. "I'll be your pack horse."
"If I gave you 2 grapes, his mother said scornfully, "it would break your back."
Da Shan sighed. "Why so hard, Mama?" he said,
and Big Mother turned, the trousers dangling from her fingertips. Her face softened, and Da Shan sat up, took the trousers, folded them, and rolled them up, and handed them back to her.
"You'll need these, Mama," he said, and smiled.
Julie clutched her violin and turned in the direction of the conservatory. The spring sky was a haze of pink and gray. She walked slowly, listening to the scores in her bag rustling like kept creatures, wondering if Kai would come to see her in room 103, or if instead she would find Yin Tai and her royal biscuit huddled indecently together. Apparently, Biscuit and Old Wu had broken up. But maybe, if she was lucky, the practice rooms would be completely still.
Once or twice now, she'd had nightmares of standing up on stage before 1,000 people. The eternally sleepless face of Chairman Mao, Zhou Enlai, and Liu Shaoqi, gazing down on her from the walls. But when she set her bow to strings, the first notes of Sigan refused to sound. The audience grew restless. They laughed as she tried to restring her violin, jeered as she replaced her bow, deafened her with abuse. But no matter what she did, her violin would not play. "Stage fright," Sparrow had told her. "It's normal to feel anxiety." The conservatory had set the date for Julie's next solo concert, mid-October, a few days after her 15th birthday. She had wanted to play Bach, or her beloved Prokofiev, but teacher Tan would not hear of it. He wanted her to aim for the next Tchaikovsky competition 4 years away. "The Ravel is a better preparation, unless you prefer Paganini's Caprice No. 24.
"I'm the daughter of a convicted rightist teacher. I won't be allowed to compete abroad."
His eyes gave nothing away. "We must have faith in the party, and you too must do your part." But 2 nights ago, Kai had told her that some, if not all, of these opportunities, competitions, scholarships, would be withdrawn. The conservatory had been unusually quiet that night. It had been so hot. Perhaps everyone had fled. "One day soon," Kai joked, "we'll arrive at the exits, but all the doors will be locked." His next solo concert had also been scheduled for October.
"If it weren't for Ba Lu, they would have never accepted me into the conservatory at all," she said. "I fully expect to be transferred to an agricultural college in Shandong province."
"All the more reason to try to go abroad."
She played a few measures of the Ravel.
"Your father is a party member, of course."
"A pure seed of the earth. A peasant who played the bamboo flute and rejoined the revolution so early, even our great helmsman didn't know there was one."
He liked to shock her. She refused to laugh.
"I don't believe anything you say, Kai."
He took her hand and held it.
"I'm glad, Julie. Never trust me."
He leaned forward and pressed his mouth to her cheek and then to her lips. The warmth of his mouth humiliated her. She turned her face, but he kept holding on to her hand, the heat of his breath against her ear. Just at the moment when she wanted to give in, to kiss him fiercely, he had released her fingers.
"Do what the old violinist says," Kai told her.
He continued as if nothing unusual had occurred.
"Play the Ravel. I can do the accompaniment if you wish."
"Fine," she said.
She was trembling. He had switched gears as smoothly as a bird circling, as unequivocally as a madman.
"Since you like it so much."
When he left, she had picked up her violin again. How had he dared? But a giddy, shameful pleasure had swelled inside her. Why had she allowed him? Now she reached the stone gates of the conservatory, where hundreds of students were milling about the courtyard, reminding her of a fire crackling. Julie went straight to her political study class. She was nearly an hour early, but still she was the last to take her seat. One of her classmates, wearing a crimson armband, made a show of taking down her name. The girl, also a violinist, was sincerely single-minded. Last summer, she had been one of the students sent out to the countryside. He Luting had refused to stop classes, and so only a limited number, the children of cadres, had been permitted to go. Most of them, including Kai, had lived in the barest shelters. Some of them had clearly never touched dirt before, but still, they came back as heroes. Back at the conservatory, they showed their newfound knowledge by continuously questioning their teachers, their parents, and music itself.
"We must take responsibility for our minds," this girl had proclaimed. "To change our consciousness, we must change our conditions."
The teacher was barred from the room. Du Li and her classmates wrote essays on discarded newspapers and butcher paper and pasted them up on the north wall. "Are we gifted?" the essays asked. "If so, who cares? What good is this music, these empty enchantments, that only entrench the bourgeoisie and isolate the poor? If it is beauty against ugliness, then choose ugliness. Comrades, the revolution depends on us." Now the class turned their attention to the playwright Wu and the poet Guo. Both men, once celebrated, had been discovered to be enemies of the people.
"Guo claims he hasn't studied Mao Zedong thought properly. He says we should burn all his books. He claims he is reformed. But we know him, comrades, don't we? The snake lies. How long has he been a party member? How long has he been a hidden traitor? And yet the authorities do nothing. We women must be at the forefront of violent class struggle. We must make it our nature. Nobody can struggle for you. Nobody can wash your face for you. Revolution is not just writing an essay or playing Song of the Gorillas."
"Exactly. The older generation used the revolution to protect their status. They've betrayed us."
The students began offering criticisms of themselves and each other, and the girl next to her, an Erhu major, mocked Du Li for favoring music in the negative and pessimistic key of E-flat minor, and continuing to play sonatas by revisionist Soviet composers, including the disgraced formalist Prokofiev. Du Li rebuked herself fiercely, vowed to embrace the optimism of the C and G major keys, and ended her self-criticism with,
"Long live the great revolution to create a proletarian culture. Long live the republic. Long live Chairman Mao."
Had she been critical enough? Too critical? Their faces, their gestures, their eyes were cold. They knew that, in the moment of speaking, she believed what she said. But as soon as class ended, clarity fell apart. All her thoughts kept intruding on each other. By the end of the study session, her hands sat on her knees like stones. Standing, she could feel her dress glued with sweat to her back and legs. Embarrassed, she sat down again, dropped her eyes, and busied herself with her books. After the class had disbanded, she wandered up one hallway and down the other, arriving at room 103 as if at the home of a confidant. She found Kai there with her cousin. Sparrow was leaning against the far wall, and when he lifted his rapt face and smiled at her, she thought his eyes had the saddest light. Kai grinned at her. She closed the door behind her and felt as if she had stepped into outer space. Bach's Goldberg Variation No. 21 gave way to a joyous, bold, and imperious No. 22. Kai played as if he were juggling a dozen silver knives, and all the edges flickered and shone. "Kai," she thought, "you are as lost as I am. You have no idea where this beauty comes from, and you know better than to think that such clarity could come from your own heart." Maybe, like Sparrow, Kai was terrified that one day the sound would shut off, his mind would go mute, and all the notes would disappear. "Dear Kai." Ah, she thought, quickly correcting herself, the word "dear" was stupid with sentimentality and had been struck from permissible usage. What should she call him then?
her eyes threatened to fill.
Jiang Kai was so much like her, and yet, in the dramatic flashing of his hands, he played every note as if it belonged to him alone. He was all capriciousness and beauty and sophisticated performance. She thought he would be better suited to the hot-headed genius of Beethoven or Rachmaninoff, or even the modernist high-rises of Stravinsky. Bach, she'd always thought, was a coded man. A strange fish, a composer who loved God and devoted himself to the numeric order of the world, but whose heart was fragmented. He existed outside of time. One day, Kai would play Bach with all the ardor that the composer called forth, but not yet. Kai was still too young, too certain. At her insistence, Sparrow played the first movement of his unfinished Symphony No. 3, while she and Kai leaned against the wall. The opening slid from the key of E-flat major to an unexpectedly luminous B minor. She heard atonality etched into a falsely harmonious surface. She heard brittle ruptures and time speeding up like a wheel spinning even faster. For all her talent, and for all of Kai's, it was Sparrow, she knew, who had the truest gift. His music made her turn away from the never-possible and the almost-here, away from an unmade, untested future. The present, Sparrow seemed to say, is all we have. Yet it is the one thing we will never learn to hold in our hands. While others in the conservatory gave poetic names to their work, Young Soldier's Joy or 30 Miles to the Courier Station, Sparrow, as usual, gave only a number. Yet Zhu Li imagined she could hear her father's presence in the music just as clearly as if when the dreamer's name was written on the page. Could his name be written there in secret? Bach, for instance, had encrypted the four letters of his name into a single motif. These four notes, where in the German system B is B-flat and H is B-natural, served as his signature, surfacing through the music. And hadn't Schumann encoded the town where his lover was born? It would be just like her cousin to speak without speaking. Julie's left hand was playing an invisible violin, and when she noticed herself doing this, she abruptly stopped. Still, she heard a recurring pattern inside Sparrow's new work, as if they were the very footsteps of Wen the Dreamer. At night, her father walked across her own dreams, too. Since escaping the camp, where could he possibly hide? Last month, Zhu Li had overheard her mother saying that the bodies of those who died in the desert camps were left to decompose in the sand dunes. Scientists and teachers, longtime party members, doctors, soldiers, paper pushers and engineers, more than enough to build a better China in the underworld. "Careful, even ghosts are illegal here," Big Mother had said.
"The lie is too big. I can't pretend. I don't wish to."
Big Mother Knife said that another purge was coming. There were rumors in her unit.
"I'm a stupid fool," Swirl said. "I was a fool."
In what way has she been a fool? Zhu Li wondered. What did she mean? Big Mother had dissolved the melancholy with a long, rumbling burp. "If you can't pretend to be a communist, the only answer is..." Abruptly, Sparrow stopped playing.
"It's unfinished," he said. "I can't go on."
"But it's extraordinary," Kai exclaimed. "It's your masterpiece." Blushing, Sparrow handed Zhu Li her violin.
"It's nothing," he said.
To banish the awkwardness in the room, she chose Isaïe's Sonata in the dubious E minor key. She envied the composer's intellect,
the observant compassion that Sparrow possessed, and wished to cultivate it within herself. But it was impossible. She was a performer, a transparent glass giving shape to water, nothing more than a glass. When the sonata ended, Kai leaped up and rushed from the room.
"Some people really don't like E minor,"
Julie murmured.
"Perhaps he has an assignation."
It was late, almost midnight.
"I don't think our pianist has a lover."
Sparrow looked faint. To bring the color back to his face, she reminded him that his mother and hers were packing their bags. They were leaving for the hinterlands of Gansu.
"It's better for Aunt Swirl. Shanghai is uneasy right now," he said.
"Why?"
He didn't answer. Julie wanted to ask him about fear because this unease inside of her, it too was a kind of desertification, a kind of hunger. And where would it end? It was cutting a fault line, running all the way to her hands. But at that moment, Kai returned.
"The professor brought food for us," Kai said, holding up 3 helpings of noodles, 3 wheat buns, and, stunningly, a small jar of wine. Julie had no idea who the professor was, but decided it didn't matter. Her stomach was rumbling. The melancholy in her cousin's eyes vanished as if it had never been. Kai said some students had returned from demonstrating, but the streets were calm.
Calm for you, Julie thought.
Both Kai and her cousin had unassailable class backgrounds. They were sons of the soil, sons of revolutionary heroes, sons of... She laughed and drank the wine. Her cousin's face was hazy with joy. She and Kai squeezed together on the bench. The alcohol made her thoughts light and immodest, and she decided to climb up on the bench and salute her cousin. Kai wrapped an arm around her legs to prevent her from toppling over, and the pressure of his hands made Julie want to push him away, and yet, also, collapse into his arms.
"Cousin Sparrow," she proclaimed, "twice my age."
"So old," he protested.
"But my best friend in all the world. I shall stand beside you when the flood comes."
"May the flood bypass us all, sweet Julie," Sparrow said.
"May the flood lift us to better shores," Kai said.
Julie was the first to give in to exhaustion. She left them. Outside the practice room, she stood listening for a few moments, waiting for the music or voices to start up again, but there was nothing. And yet, early the next morning, when the conservatory was still quiet, here he was, just as he had promised. Dear Kai, that exhausted performer, half draped over the piano as if over the arm of an old friend.
"You're late, Comrade Julie," he said.
"Did you sleep here?"
"With my eyes open and a pen in my hand."
"Writing self-criticisms, I'm sure."
He smiled. How tired he looked, and yet electrified, as if he had just emerged from a 10-hour seminar with Glenn Gould himself.
"The truth is," he said, "I'd never even heard of Sigan. I came early in order to practice it. I feared you would drop me from your concert and perform with Yin Chai instead."
"So you mastered it?"
There it was again, the proud shine in his eyes.
"Of course."
After playing it through once, they sat facing one another, cross-legged on the floor.
"Did you listen to the Oystrick recording?" she asked him.
"A dozen times. I found it eerie and couldn't stop. I also listened to Heifetz and Nouveau."
"Professor Tan told me to think about it alongside Guinaud's Faust,"
Julie said.
"You know, all that you desire I can give you. Selling your soul to the evil spirits,
the usual thing.
Tan had said that the violin score of Sigan was devilishly difficult. Perfect, she had thought. Kai nodded and made illegible floating marks on his score.
The piano part is mysterious, isn't it?
He turned a few pages.
First, it enters late. Second, I find it cold. See how it never loses control and is never out of breath? And yet I feel there's a great hunger there. It wants to control things, to push the violin closer to the edge, maybe.
It was true. In the last third, the violin spun in faster and faster, nearly impossible circles. She said aloud, without thinking,
"Not love then, but something like it."
She and Kai played the piece again, and the incompatibility between the two instruments heightened, like a dance between two lovers who had long since ruined one another and yet moved forward in the same maddening steps. It doesn't end well, thought Julie, reaching for the notes, her back pinched, her neck aching. She was the devil playing. The walls of room 103 danced sideways and seemed to give way to her, as if she had become the rain and torrent. The music ended. She sat down at the piano and stared at the keys. Kai took up her hands, which were hot and damp. She hated it when people touched her hands. They were sensitive and in constant pain, and she'd had dreams in which they were crushed or cut open. As if he could read her thoughts, he let them go, picked up his pencil, and tapped the score.
"You see more in each measure than any violinist at the conservatory."
"The conservatory is a tiny corner of the world."
She took the pencil from him, flipped to the Meno Vivo, and said,
"Here is where I stumbled, fatally. Let's go back once more."
His hand floated down her back. She moved to stand up, but his hand was around her waist.
"Julie."
His voice was too near to her, his mouth pressed against her hair.
"Don't be afraid," he said.
She wasn't afraid. Only, she thought, letting his mouth find hers, "there are too many people, too many words, too many things that I wish for. I have the feeling there is too little time." They kissed. She didn't know that she was still upright. She felt as if she had lain down on the floor of the room. She pulled away and stood up and went to her violin as if nothing had happened, proud that she could be as uncaring as him, and tested the first bars of Sigan. Her mind felt resolute and numb, but her heart was exhilarated. Kai was smiling at her. What did he feel, she wondered. Deep down in that secret part of him, was there anyone he really trusted? She willed herself to disappear into Ravel. She let herself go into the walls and into sound itself. Chapter 6. Without our realizing it, the weeks following Ai Ming's departure became months, and the months years. On May 18th, 1996, I was watching television and attempting to solve a hard problem. Let D be a positive integer that is not a perfect square. Prove that the continued fraction of square root of D is periodic. When the telephone rang. Ai Ming's voice was miraculously clear, as if all that was required of me was to reach out my hand and pull her into the room. I was overjoyed. It had been a month since her last letter, and Ma and I were expecting good news. After 5 long years, the rumored amnesty had finally materialized, and Ai Ming, along with nearly 500,000 others, had submitted her application for permanent residence in the United States. "Ma Li," she said, "I call to wish you happy birthday."
I had just turned 17. Aiming rained questions on me about Ma, math camp, my plan.